I'm Roger Baker, Executive Director of the Stratfor Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Learn how you can put geopolitics to work for your organization at RAINnetwork.com.
Hello and welcome to RAIN's Essential Geopolitics podcast. My name is Emma Kami, and for today's episode, I'll be talking with RAIN's Eurasia analyst, Matthew Orr, about the mobilization issues Ukraine is currently facing and what it means for the outlook of the country's conflict with Russia. Hi, Matthew. How are you?
Hey, Emma. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you on. To start us off, Ukraine's Verkhovna Rada is expected to begin considering amendments to a long-awaited draft law on mobilization in the coming days. Can you explain what the history of this law is and why it's so important?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of why it's so important, I think that can be addressed pretty quickly, which is just that Ukraine needs manpower to continue the war. Remember that Russia's population is at least 3.5 to 4 times as large as Ukraine's. And so in that, you know, reality, Ukraine faces a severe manpower deficit, which means that it's always going to be on the back foot looking for additional manpower to be able to continue the war, resisting capitulations to Russia's demands for a ceasefire. And so in that reality, they need a new law like this precisely because they are not able to get a constant flow of new recruits into the army in a way that Russia is. Ukraine did do a large-scale mobilization at the very start of the war in 2022. But then since then, its flows of new manpower has been quite small and has basically involved enforcement actions of previously agreed to mobilization measures. Whereas Russia put off its initial mobilization until September of 2022, but then since then has received a large injection of manpower and has been able to continue with like a smaller, steady flow of manpower. And so in this reality, the Ukrainians have been discussing the need for more mobilization for a long time. Really, the history of this issue goes back to the end of last year when Ukraine's counteroffensive began to culminate. And at that time, there was already tensions between the head of the Ukrainian armed forces at the time, General Zaluzhny, and President Zelensky, about what the path forward was. Of course, Zaluzhny said that we need much more manpower. And that led to conflicts, you know, between the presidential administration, between the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, i.e. the president, and the actual head of the army about this issue. Zelensky and the administration was very skeptical of doing this large-scale mobilization if it wasn't clearly attached to a very clear plan that really examined what the effects of this would be on Ukraine from all standpoints. And of course, the administration didn't want all of the, you know, negative political ramifications for this step to be attached to them. And so basically what's happened is that there was a presidential version of this law that was submitted to the parliament almost a few months ago at this point. And now it's been steadily progressing. It's gone through numerous drafts. And now it's kind of at least beginning to near what looks like the end of that process, where thousands of amendments to the law have been submitted, and it's under final discussion. And so it's really needed to actually get them the manpower that they need to continue the war. The problem is that it's unclear exactly, you know, which of these amendments will be adopted and what exactly the final version will look like.
As you were just mentioning, the law has been the topic of considerable speculation for months, reportedly subject to a total of 4,195 amendments, leading Ukrainian parliamentarians to speculate that it is the subject of one of the most proposed amendments in history. What can we expect to make of the final version of the law, and what are its implications?
Yeah, that's really kind of the key to this question at this point. What we do know is that this law, you know, it would be a gigantic waste of time for this law to go through a huge legal process and then essentially be, you know, defanged and essentially not even allow the Ukrainians to get the manpower that they actually need, right? And so in that vein, I think it's very clear that some of the key provisions needed to get more manpower are going to have to stay in the amendment. We're talking about, most importantly, the lowering of the de facto age at which men are actively mobilized from 27 to 25. That would bring in a new large group of soldiers who were potentially earlier not subject to mobilization. But it's also, you know, it's really painful demographically because these younger people are more likely to, you know, start families and have children and so on. But also because as you go to younger and younger people in Ukraine, younger and younger age groups, that proportion of the population is actually getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's not necessarily a long-term solution, but it's definitely where they the easiest place to kind of draw more clearly military capable manpower. And so it seems like that provision has to stay. The other main place where more manpower can come from is adjusting the grounds for exemptions, various medical and other administrative exemptions. Things like if you're, you know, what's your student status, what's your, you know, what exactly your job status is, things like that. That can also bring in more manpower for, among Ukrainians that are currently exempt. Those are the kinds of amendments or the kinds of provisions that clearly need to make it into the final law. But as you said, yes, there's a huge amount of amendments that have been proposed. They've been reportedly gathered into something like 16 different kind of groups or types of amendments or like the topics that they're really addressing. And so we don't know exactly which combinations of these will stay, but that could draw out the process. And that's also not good either, because you'll remember that this law has already been delayed probably farther than it should have. I mean, the Ukrainian military high command was, as I just mentioned, talking about more mobilization back in at least November of last year. And so the longer this goes, the more problems this creates for the Ukrainian army, because it's not clear when the law will get passed. It takes at least a few months to normally train freshly mobilized men, even if once you do pass a law like this. And so all of this creates an environment where it seems like the Russians are going to have the advantage on the battlefield for the foreseeable future, so long as this law remains, bottled up in parliament. In terms of its implications, it definitely still has other significant implications for Ukraine itself. When you do more mobilization like this, you inevitably prompt further men seeking to escape, right? If their exemptions are going away, then they might, instead of being mobilized, they might seek to go to the European Union to illegally leave Ukraine. They're actually not allowed to, men of a certain age, unless you have a very specific permission. And so it seems like that's a very clear implication of this. The other is just that the economics effects of that, of the further tightening of the workforce. Longer-term demographic issues that I mentioned earlier. And so that's why the government has also tried to do things to attract more of the Ukrainian men who are actually currently in the European Union to come back, although for clear reasons it seems like that's going to be, you know, certainly an uphill battle. In terms of the implications for the war more broadly, yeah, it does bring the question of what Russia will do to respond to this. The Ukrainians are, you know, it's interesting. The report suggests that the Ukrainians seek to get at least about 300,000 more men, which is a really large amount at this point in the war. And it seems like mainly the idea is that they want to be able to rotate a lot of their frontline soldiers so that their frontline people aren't on the frontline all the time. The problem is that, you know, more ambitious numbers that have been thrown around, for example, you know, 500,000, that would allow the Ukrainians to potentially get more manpower on the front lines and allow them to eventually return to offensive actions, if not this year, then maybe, say, in 2025 or even in 2026. The problem, though, is that the Russians are not going to just sit by idly, right? They're also potentially going to conduct more mobilization measures to respond to this, to keep a rough parity on the front line. And so it's somewhat doubtful that this mobilization by the Ukrainians will be able to, you know, fundamentally alter the trajectory of the war in that regard.
Speaking of Russia's response, how does Ukraine's approach to mobilization, as reflected in the draft law, compare to Russia's at this point in the war? And what does this say about the war's trajectory?
Yeah, so I think it says that, you know, President Putin is increasingly, you know, despite the obvious, you know, human and economic and other costs that this is having for the Russian people, Putin is constantly trying to project this image that he doesn't care about how many Russians are mobilized and die in this conflict, and he's, you know, not deterred by the losses. On the other hand, he says that, you know, the Russian armed forces do everything they can to, you know, protect or save the lives of their soldiers, but, you know, through their actual actions on the ground, there's a clear indication for a disregard for casualties. That's why the Russians are, despite taking disproportionate casualties, seeking to continue offensive actions along the front. I think that the Russians are going to continue those offensive actions until they very clearly think that the amount of mobilization the Ukrainians are doing is enough to actually more effectively stop the Russians from gaining ground as they are currently. That situation, as I mentioned earlier, is not going to change, at least for the next several months in the summer. Conditions are still favorable for Russia. The Russians also think that the conditions being in their favor might be a slightly temporary action, right? Because this Ukrainian mobilization could result in more Ukrainians in a few months. Also, you're going to have potentially more packages of Western weapons support reaching Ukraine, things like that. But for the Ukrainians, it really shows that instead of being able to very easily go for a much more ambitious mobilization package, the Ukrainians themselves are more focused on rotating their current soldiers rather than going for the most ambitious, economically and politically challenging forms of mobilization to actually try to get some clear manpower advantage over the Russians again, as the Ukrainians did enjoy briefly towards the end of 2022 and early part of 2023. But now, yeah, it seems like it's going to be very hard for the Ukrainians to ever return to a situation like that. And so, yes, that inevitably has a lot of long-term implications when thinking about the future of the war. I think in the West, the Western countries are going to ask, you know, what can we do to help the Ukrainians get more manpower to the front? And one of the clear answers to that is NATO countries increasing the size of their, you know, various advisor contingents that are already in Ukraine. You know, the British government, even the U.S. government, you know, have more or less acknowledged that they have, again, in non-combat roles, but, you know, all kinds of special operators and non-combat advisors working in Ukraine. It seems like other countries are going to increasingly consider what more they can do in a similar vein. And that's what I think that the recent comments, by the way, by the French president about, you know, what options are there with regards to the positioning of more NATO personnel in Ukraine. That conversation is definitely, I don't think it's going to develop into something particularly new anytime soon, but the conversation itself is not going to disappear by any means. So in general, all this points to, right, the West, the Ukrainians, trying to do what they can to maintain some semblance of balance on the battlefield, try to slow Russia's gains, and eventually, you know, try to wait out the Russians, degrade their forces, even if the Russians constantly express, you know, supreme confidence in the trajectory of the war. Things can change inside Russia itself, and Russian forces can get degraded on the battlefield in a way maybe unexpected from what they from their calculations, and that can, you know, cause a change in the shift of the initiative on the battlefield. Again, if not this year, then maybe sometime in 2025 or beyond.
Well, thanks for that overview, Matthew. It's always great to hear your insights.
Yeah, for sure.
You can read more of Matthew's analyses by subscribing to one of Rain's risk intelligence products. Our suite of products and solutions allow clients to access the insights and analyses they need to make more informed decisions. You can sign up or learn more at our website, rainnetwork.com. That's RANENetwork.com. I'm Emma Kami. Thanks for listening.